And everybody wants to work. Na na na.
Hello and welcome to Life of Brian, Dr. Dot Mannix, that is. Let's go straight to the penthouse where all the action's happening, and there he is, our rock star in residence, Brian Mannix.
Well, the penthouse has been pretty empty this week, Kev, this weekend. I've been down in Melbourne and working hard, played at the, some sort of gay festival in Daylesford, fantastic. Great people and beautiful costumes, and then worked yesterday. Well, no. It was really good because, you know, early
don't sound people, so surprised.
Well, it was great to see all these old people who suddenly got the rainbow gear on, the glitter and stuff. I don't even know if they were gay or lesbian or whatever, but everybody embraced it, and it looked like Victoria was just chock-a-block with, you know, festivals and stuff this weekend. So, yeah, it was a good weekend.
A big weekend for festivals being cancelled too, which was not a bad thing given the heat wave that ran through rampant through Victoria. You'd actually be back in the nice, cool confines of the Gold Coast.
Well, it's about 29 here, but yeah, I think it was 36 yesterday and, down in Melbourne. But, good to see my friends down in Melbourne and enjoy the hot weather in Melbourne, which is rare.
Very, very rare. And we're sick of it already. three days will do, thanks. It's like Woodstock. 3 days, that's it. Let's go. Piss off.
Yeah, when it gets hot down in Melbourne, it's really hot. Gee whiz, it's hot.
Yeah, it is.
Very
impressive. Well, I'll tell you what you also have to tell people about is the hot lineup of guests we have on this show, with thanks to our very good friends at Murcott's Driving Excellence. Now, of course, while we're talking about them, I've been spending a lot of time. You've been on the road, but you've been rock-starring on the road. I've just been driving between point A and point B. The standard of driving is not getting better, so it means you're not phoning Murcott's, and you bloody well should, because we want you to be safer. Want you to get home every time and want you to be a better driver on the roads, because it affects everyone, not just you.
Well, I had to give them a call today, Kev, on 1-300-555-576, because I was getting a lift around town and I was in a Mercedes and it got a flat tyre.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if anybody's actually got the jack from a Mercedes out. They make it as difficult as possible to get it, to work out how to operate the thing. So I rang up Mark at Murcott's and they quickly put me into shape, and I fixed the tyre without having to bother the RACV. And, and you know, it's these little things, you know, even when you're on a trip, how to pack your car, you know, what your tyre pressure should be, you know, you're going to all of that stuff, and just driving well. So 1-300-555-576.
Little Paddy is our main guest on this program. And then
I thought it was dinner.
Dinner?
Having a little patty.
No.
Special sauce, cheese, onions, and a sesame seed bun.
She is special, though. God, gee, she's packed a lot into her her career from, a little teenage superstar with her very first song getting to number two and only being kept out of the number one spot by some mob called the Beatles.
Never heard of them. They'll never kick on then. Rubbish.
So she started like that, and then she did amazing work. She did go into Vietnam, and we're going to talk to her about the fact that she was there in the biggest battle of the Vietnam War. Then she went to Afghanistan.
I believe she won the Battle of Long Tan. She got out there with an M16 and she just took care of that NVA like there was no tomorrow.
As opposed to you, who's won the bottle of fake tan, which is just a totally different kettle of fish. Then we're going to talk to a bloke. Now, this is really different. Now, what was your – when you were first in the band, did you still have a job?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
I started out, I was working in a tap factory as a junior clerk, and then I worked at Coburg Teachers College in the TV department.
Right. So this bloke is the lead singer of a band called Sorted Ordeal.
Yes, they're not bad.
By night, he's the lead singer of Sorted Ordeal, but by day, and I must say very early in the day, like 5 a.m., when most band people are just going to bed, he's actually up and about and heading towards his job as station announcer at Flinders Street Station.
Bone marrow train delayed. Come on. No.
Hey, his name is Lawrence Hewson. He's a good
bloke. What are you, Joe Biden?
He's a good bloke. He's a very entertaining fella. He's got a lot of strings to his bow, one of which, as we mentioned, is the, you know, announcer at Flinders Street, but also lead singer of Sorted Ordeal. And we'll play you their song, and you'll be, I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised at what this band is all about.
Well, I think you can tell that he's had plenty of microphone experience yes. on the record. Yeah. And I put it all down to Flinders Street Station, where he keeps, you know, all of Melbourne working and getting where they want to go. Top bloke, good song, worth having a listen to.
That is coming up later on. But first up, we start with, lady who has just been around the music scene for many, many years and is just an absolute ripper. Here is Little Patty.
Legend.
Let's talk about the show that that people can go and see you at during this year, which is the Good Old Days of Rock and Roll show. Tell us about your involvement in that and who's in it.
Oh, the Good Old Days of Rock and Roll has turned out to be one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. It includes, well, it is all about people from, who started their careers a long time ago, but people who still perform and perform well. Jade Hurley, Big Ravel, Lucky Star, Dinah Lee, and I. And we're having a great time doing the show. The people in the audiences are loving it as well. And it's such a pleasure to walk out and see a big arena full of smiling faces with grey hair, silver hair. sets the atmosphere for you. But, I mean, anyone would, you know, most people I think would enjoy it, but certainly the people that grew up with it, that kind of music. And it's all about the early days of rock and roll with a few more modern things thrown in, but there wouldn't be a song that isn't well known by the audiences.
Does Digger Ravel behave on those shows, Patty?
He sure does. He performs extremely well. Gee, he's a good performer. He really is.
I know he performs well, but I'm just wondering when he's not on stage, how he's behaving. He's a lot of fun.
We all behave very well. And no, seriously, he's terrific. I think Digger's a real gentleman. To me, he's an absolute gentleman. And, he's a boy, and aren't you all?
Yeah, they always sit me next to Digger at these lunches because they go, yeah, there's a couple of rat bags there, stick them together.
Well, there you go. Good fun. Digger's good fun.
He's great fun, really great fun.
What is it about those songs and about that era and about the performers that came out of that era, Patty, that you think has sustained them to you know, 60 years later?
Yeah, look, I really am not sure, except that when all of us, each of us, began our careers, we were certainly, you know, started off as perhaps promising performers. But, well, I can only speak for myself, really. I was thrown in at the deep end. I had no intention or desire to be a professional performer because I was a quite shy kid and I loved music. I loved having lessons. I learnt piano and singing, but that was the extent of it. I really enjoyed playing and learning new songs. But, gosh, you know, to be on a stage, I used to think, those people, aren't they good? But they're real show-offs. And that was, you know, when you're a teenager, that's the last thing most of us want to be, is a show-off. But a show-off I became because I accidentally won a talent quest and then, you know, someone had phoned EMI and said, oh, there's this kid, you know, she's 14 and she can sing and come and see her, she sings. By which time I'd had one talent quest win, but the news got around to EMI Records, and before I knew it, I was with my parents signing a contract one day after school in my school uniform, and several weeks later I had a record climbing the charts. So it was sudden, it was accidental, and I ideally wanted to finish school. I did. I wanted to. I thought I must have had my head, you know, firmly in place, because I didn't think my newfound fame, sudden fame, was going to last. I thought, oh, this would be nice for a little while, as Mum kept saying. But it kept going, and I had to make the decision to stay at school or leave. And I thought if it got too hard to do both, so I to think about both, I left school thinking it would only be for a little while and that I could go back and continue my school, go to university and be a doctor. That's what I really wanted to do.
Well, can I pick you up on that? Isn't that what you told the EMI talent scout when he said, would you like to come and do an audition for us in the big EMI studios in Sydney?
I did. He said, why don't you come and audition? And I said, oh, no thanks. I was very polite. No, thank you. I'm going to be a doctor. Which, when I hear those words now, I laugh to myself, you know, that I was shy but not too shy, that I suddenly became a bit bold and said, no, I want to be a doctor. You know, it's funny, isn't it?
And one little thing I want to ask about is, you said you accidentally won your first talent quest.
Well, yeah.
Go on, tell us the real story. What happened? Go on.
Well, my best friend at the time, Marilyn, was the only person in our group who went to the beach every weekend on Saturday afternoon. And if we'd all done our homework, if I'd done my homework, I might have been able to go on Sundays as well. And my brother was meant to look after me. I was 14 and he was 2 years older. And come on, who knows someone, an older brother that really wants to look after their little sister. But look, we'd separate at the dance. We'd separate at the beach. He'd go into the water and have a good time, and I'd lie on the beach. You fellas probably remember. I'm sure the female listeners remember those little triangle bikinis that we loved so much. And endlessly try and get that gold tan. I didn't succeed. I have the lovely Anglo-Celtic complexion, white as. And anyway, we heard word got around that the next, this was a Saturday, and this particular week we heard that the next day there would be a dance called the Stomp Dance at this local surf club. And we thought, wow, the Stomp Dance. And we'd not heard of it coming from America, and we still maintain we invented the stomp. And so it was, look, it was the best time. It started at 2 o'clock and probably finished about 5. I'm not sure. Real live band, loud, so you didn't have to worry about conversation. You didn't have to worry about a partner. You could just stomp away to your heart's content, which is what we were doing. And then sometime later in the day, the promoter of the dance, whose name was Paul Graham, and he was a very nice man, and he went on to become a bodybuilding expert.
Yeah, right? I remember him. Yeah.
He looked like Arnie Schwarzenegger, really.
He was a Mr. Australia or a Mr. Universe or something, wasn't he? Yeah, I remember him.
He was our answer to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He really was. And, yep, anyway.
I didn't realise it was the same Paul Graham.
That's him, yeah. And he announced that there'd be a talent quest, and that went in one ear and out the other for me. But my my friend Marilyn said, Patricia can sing. She even has lessons. And embarrassment. Oh, gosh, you know, I could feel the blood draining from my face. And then because the kids were trying to pick me up and carry me onto the stage, and, you know, that big, can you remember being embarrassed as a teenager? I can. It's really, really strong and intense. And I thought, oh, no. And, you know, they're trawling me up to the stage, and I thought, I can either try and run away now or get up and sing and be done with it. So I chose the latter and sang a song, and it went really, really well. And theoretically, I won the talent quest. This is the accidental part. I did win the talent quest, but nobody else entered.
Oh.
Well, you won't. You legitimately won.
Look, I didn't want to win anything, you know. I wanted to be just like all the other kids.
Singing Easier Said Than Done and Surfer Joe, I believe.
That's right. You have done your research. And they were two big hits of the day. And Easier Said Than Done was quite a good song, I thought.
Yeah, it was a good song.
Surfer Joe was a fun song. And I remember some of the kids singing along to it too, which was, you know, wow.
If you're this nervous about going on stage, how do you go a couple of months later when you're going on Bandstand and on television? That must have been even more nerve-wracking for you.
Oh, it was incredibly nerve-wracking. And, you know, I can't tell you the feelings. You feel that every muscle in your body is twitching and your knees are shaking and literally, you know, that's how it is. Yeah, no, it's not a nice feeling, but if you ever get to watch it, the replay, all you can do is just be gobsmacked with the fact that that didn't show. You know, it looked like we performers were cool, calm, collected. And in the main, I don't think we were. I think we were all, you know, in varying degrees of shyness and lack of confidence, sometimes not really knowing what we were doing. We were thrown in at the deep end and learning how to use a camera, to work a camera. These are all skills that we didn't know, but by gee, we quickly learned them. We had to.
Yeah. November 1963, which is only a couple of weeks really after you did the talent show, He's My Blonde-Haired Stompy Wompy Real Gone Surfer Boy is your debut single. And gets to nationally, it charted about 15 or 16, but gets to number two in your hometown in Sydney.
It did, and I don't know who was more surprised. Yeah, it was. It certainly was, and it was actually a double-sided hit, which is pretty unusual. The other side was called Stompin' at Maroubra, and today that is requested as much as Stompy Wompy Real Gone Surfer Boy, so I was pretty fortunate.
And some little outfit called the Beatles were number one, kept you out of the number one spot?
Yeah, but who cares? Exactly. Who cares about that, yeah. So that was, was a lovely time and a surprising time for me. And as I think back, and all I can say is that, you know, for the rest of my life, but particularly in those formative years, my life was just a blur of work. And work consisted of making records, performing live performances, going on tour with live performances, also appearances at shopping centres all over the place. And that's how my life became. And it's kind of still like that, Kevin. Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, we've talked about Digger and Lucky and the
China, yeah, and Jade,
and the camaraderie that you have with them. There was a camaraderie among the performers, the Bandstand team, I guess, the Brian Henderson put together. People like Cole Joy and yourself and Billy Thorpe.
Well, look, Billy Thorpe was a great mate for me. He was terrific, and the best mate of all of them for me is Cole Joy still. And, you know, he's my darling dearest friend, but all of them are darling dearest friends. You know, Dinah and I just love each other's company. We giggle a lot, laugh a lot, tell stories, have a mighty time. But so does Lucky, Jade and Digger. It's terrific to see each other. We've had a little break from the show. I think the last show was in December of Good Old Days of Rock and Roll. And the reason why is we took time off for Jade Hurley, who has had, I'm sure your listeners will know exactly, a rotator cuff shoulder injury. And that had to be rebuilt. It went very successfully. Now he's resting and doing lots of rehab as well. So he'll be fighting fit. You know, it's lovely to open the book and the diary and see so many gigs coming in for this show of oldies. It's terrific. Yeah. Now I got my beach towel and I'm heading down to the surf. Gonna see my Johnny, gonna meet him down at the surf. We're gonna shoot the breakers, gonna stomp in the sand. I look in his eyes while he holds my hand.
cause he's my blonde headed stalker, my real gone surfer boy. Yeah, 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 yeah. All the gang from the club will be surfing and stomping too. Riding their boards out on that sea of blue. While the summer sun is a beating on down, I'll be stomping and surfing all around. Come on, Johnny. Let's get going. Here I am, Johnny.
Okay, Sandy.
Let's go surfing.
Okay, Sandy.
Gee, it's great.
Sure is.
Oh, Johnny.
Ah, it's great.
Gonna stay with my Johnny for the beach party tonight. Yeah, surfing and stomping sure makes you feel right. When it's over, I won't be alone. For my Johnny's gonna walk me home. Cause he's my blonde headed stompy one for real gone surfer boy. Yeah, 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 yeah. He's my blonde headed stompy one for real gone surfer boy. Yeah, 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 yeah. He's my blonde headed stompy one for real gone surfer boy.
Speaking of touring, you toured Vietnam during the war and entertained the troops. How did that come about, and can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, sure. It came about. It was about April 1966. I was at home with my mother. I wasn't on tour and we were just at home, and the phone rang and she answered, and all I could hear her say, and I'll never forget it, was, "Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask her father." And I thought, what have I done wrong? What's gone, you know? And this conversation repeated itself day after day. And it was a phone call from one of the heads of the Defence Department of Australia's, you know, Commonwealth Defence Department, asking for my mum's and dad's permission for me to go to Vietnam and sing for our troops. And the first concert party went in 1965 for the government, and that was Lorraine Desmond, and which was lovely. And we were the second only concert party to go. My father really, you know, went bananas. He didn't want me to go. He said, "No, this is not our war to fight. Someone else's war, blah, blah, blah." And, you know, I don't know if you're old or young enough to remember that Australia was, well, the first time in my life I saw it as a very much divided country, and a bit like the Yes, No campaign. It was strictly divided. And my dad, he was put his foot down and he said, "No, you know, not a real, you know, all that." Anyway, my mum, who was receiving these calls all the time because dad was at work, eventually, like he weakened, which is not the right word, but he understood why I wanted to go. Number one, which is a very selfish motive, but I had not been overseas. And I thought this would be overseas. Had no idea of what a war meant. When you're 17, you don't know anything. And what's more, that horrific barrage of clips, film, photos and clips were not on our national TV screens yet. We'd maybe had two headlines in the news every day about the current conflict in Vietnam, and that was about it. But in actual fact, I soon discovered it was a very serious war and we were losing Australians. And anyway, when Cole Joy had agreed to go and promised mum and dad he'd look after me, which, you know, that particular show I was involved with pretty well all my life, and indeed I was very well looked after, but I was also very well looked after by the Australian Defence Force. They were fantastic. And I was probably a bit spoiled, actually, because I was so little, so young, youngest person to go at the time. And it was a wonderful experience. It had every emotion, sad, happy. I learnt a lot. I learnt what being in the war meant and why we were there. And I learnt the history of, you know, it was very much a war-torn country, Vietnam. And everybody had been there trying to win a war, but no one had, including us and including the Americans. we didn't win the war, which was, you know, I believe a big part of the reason that when our fabulous troops came home, they weren't recognised to the degree that they should have been. They certainly were not understood and almost frowned upon, which is cruel. I thought we were not very kind to them at all. And, you know, it taught me a lot of lessons. And, you know, I forever and a day I'll always do my what I can to for the well-being of our Vietnam veterans.
Patricia, you're playing down what happened to you over there, though. I mean, you were only a couple of kilometres away from the Battle of Long Tam when it actually started. You had to be evacuated out by Iroquois helicopters to be able to, you had to get off the stage and get out of there.
That's true. It was hairy, to say the least. And, I think as you get older, certain events in your life become indelibly printed and don't shift. And that day and that evening, certainly moments like that, we were doing our third show for the day. Nui Dat, which is where we were performing at the base, is huge. It was the Australian Task Force base. And there were about 2,000 or 3,000 Australians there. So we were there early in the, early-ish in the morning and due to do three shows, which we did, but our third show was cut short because of, during the second show, I could hear lots of activity in the form of explosions and gunfire seemingly very close to us. And I thought, well, we must be all right because the audience hasn't moved. They must know what they're doing. And indeed they did, but that was almost normal, that sort of thing. But I didn't realise, and none of us performers, we didn't let it, harm our performance. We just kept, the show must go on. And it wasn't until the third show where we didn't have all that much longer to go before we finished. We had to be off at 10 to 4. Curfews that were given to us every day about departures, arrival, show times, show beginnings, show endings, the curfews must be strictly adhered to. And so we were aiming to finish at 10 to 4 and just before then, actually. We must have been, we were ready to do our last song. And our escorting officer came to the side of the stage and put, if you can imagine, putting your index finger across your throat, which means get off the stage. And that's stage talk. And he kept repeating it until we got off stage. And by which time officers had left the scene, lots of soldiers were scurrying away as well. So they had the call somehow that they had to go over to the nearby rubber plantation and join in on the serious battle that was taking place. And by about 5 to 4, there were sirens, like really loud sirens. And I don't know if you've been to Southeast Asia, but it seems to rain at 4 o'clock every day. So we had torrential blinding rain, the sirens, and just a cacophony of noise and action. And we were taken to a jeep, sort of came in out of the rain and took us to the nearby Iroquois, and we were evacuated. And we flew over the battle, which was really something really, the feelings. And we knew it was serious for many reasons, but the two young soldiers who were with us in the helicopter, the Iroquois, they were... normally there's banter. Every helicopter ride you have, it's good fun, and the young soldiers are thrilled to be looking after us and we're thrilled to be looked after by them. But this day they were ashen-faced and there was not a word spoken, but we were able to see very clearly that there were explosions just underneath us. There were thousands of red lights, which I found out later were tracer bullets, all part of the battle. And, yeah, so that was the Battle of Long Tan in all its awful glory.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. But happily for you, it has a happy ending. Thank goodness.
Well, yeah, it did. I mean, we were the lucky ones. And do you know that fight, I love telling Vietnam veterans this story because, as I said before, for many of them, they've been troubled mentally about, you know, their time in the war. And I subsequently went to Iraq years later to perform for our forces. And on one occasion, actually it was the first concert we did there, I couldn't believe it was like being in Vietnam again, except that the people in the audience, there were lots of young female, you know, soldiers. I said, wow, yeah, this is terrific. And many of them were American and not so many Australian and Iraq. And when I mentioned that I, you know, when I was a lot younger, went to Vietnam, and one fella yelled out, "Are you the little gal that was in the Battle of Long Tan?" And I nodded, and they all stood up and applauded, you know, which was quite remarkable. I wasn't sure quite why, but later on they were so quick to tell me, every American was quick to tell me without fail, that when they were learning to be soldiers, when they were in training, as well as the physical routine, they had lots of theory. And the most outstanding battle that they learned about, and the one that they held in high esteem, and, you know, wow, the Battle of Long Tan. And they kept telling me, I used to get quite emotional about it, that you have the best soldiers in the whole wide world, because, you know, to have been in that battle and to have won it. And, yeah, so that, there you go. That's our Vietnam veterans.
Yeah. Mm. And your OAM that you got, was a lot of that was to do with the work you did post the war with the veterans.
No, it wasn't actually. No, I received a medal for going to Vietnam, but it wasn't another. It was a logistic and support medal. But I got an OAM, thankfully, for my work, charity work, and my work supporting fellow performers, because I was the president of the Media Entertainment and Arts Alliance. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you're in the ARIA Hall of Fame.
Mm.
You've had postage stamps.
Mm. Oh, I like that.
How's it feel like in the back of your head?
I thought it was pretty good, actually. The other one that made me feel even happier than that is something rather silly but lovely.
Is that the little petty flower?
Yeah. Who'd have thought? And I got embarrassed. I thought, oh, I want to grow some of these little dahlias and little petty dahlias, and they were yellow. And then I got embarrassed to go into the garden shop to buy them. So I went in with sunglasses and a cap, and I said in a serious voice, "You wouldn't happen to have a little putty dahlias, would you?" I bought a packet of seeds, and I smiled all the way home. Couldn't wait to grow them.
Mm. There wasn't a, you know, check out 10, 4'10" woman asking for little putty dahlias.
No. Oh, no, I was embarrassed but chuffed at the same time, you know. Yeah. Fancy having a flower, yeah.
I think it's interesting that you started out doing the stomp and you ended up on a stamp. Stomp to stay.
That is a stomp to stay. Yeah, you're quite right. And I think I was the only woman on that series of stamps, which was quite amazing. But, yeah, I feel that when you get these awards, I like to think I'm hopefully representing many female performers, because I was just one of many, you know. Oh, it wasn't just me.
Gravitation pulled to the ground.
Can I ask you about the relationship between you and Chrissy?
Oh, yeah. She's...
The mild one and the wild one?
That's right. First cousins. Our fathers are brothers. She's no longer with us, which is awful. I think of her every day, and we were very close. We were very close, and it still eats my heart, actually, that she's not here. With every passing day, passing year, I mean, it just not fair.
Yeah.
She left such a mark. She was, you know, people say that my era were pioneers, and in many ways we were, but she was a pioneer of a different caliber. She really put female rock singers on the map. And I think before she came along, I don't think I know that female performers were kind of standing in amongst the band that they were working with. And whereas she came along and she took centre stage out front and said, you know, cop this, here I am. And yeah. She was incredibly talented. You know, she co-wrote all of those great songs. She was a marvellous performer. I had the thrill of many times, you know, if I wasn't working, she'd say, you want to come, cuz, to my gig at so-and-so, if it was in Sydney. And I'd stand off stage. People didn't know them, but I'd be off stage doing vocal backings for her. Wow. and enjoying every minute. Yeah. So now we were close. We had a terrific fun together.
You've done a lot of, you've taught a lot of singing, done a lot of singing lessons, but the one that intrigues me is you taught Nikki Webster how to sing before the Sydney Olympics. Could you tell us about
that? That's right. Yeah, look, she was in a group of children, and then as a solo, I taught her solo singing at a local performing arts school in the city of Sydney, right in the city, quite a big one. And she was an obvious talent, and she reminded me of me in a way because of her shyness. She wasn't a pushy kid. She was a lovely kid, and she was, I detected shyness, and yet I realised that she had something special about her. And when she was with a group of kids singing, as often was the case, she did stand out. You know, she was pretty special, very special. And so I wasn't surprised when she was chosen for that role in the Olympics. And, you know, she still performs, and she has her own performing arts school, and she's done very, very well, and she's a terrific woman. Great.
Yeah, so she did a great job at the Olympics. I think we're all
proud. Wasn't it good? Oh, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, sure was, and the little Aussie kid, eh? Yep.
Yeah, no, she was really cute. I thought that the whole, you know, opening of the Sydney Olympics was terrific, but she was probably the star of it, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Patty, how did you end up on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1970?
Oh gosh, how did I end up? Oh,
because Australians weren't going to America and doing big things in 1970.
No, not at all. And I didn't go. I was asked by a production company in Canberra to do a documentary, and it was me singing all over the world. So it went from Sydney to New Zealand, to Honolulu, to LA, to New York, to London, to Germany. And in each place, I would sing a song. And when I was in LA and New York, the Ed Sullivan Show, I suppose it was LA. Somehow, I don't know if it was my manager, Kevin Jacobson, who promoted me or suggested, I don't know, I can't remember auditioning but I was accepted to be on the Ed Sullivan Show, and which I suppose I didn't feel excited at the time. I would have felt very, very nervous. But it was just like, I do remember thinking, it's kind of no different from how we do television shows, which is probably all over the world how we do television shows.
Mm. Do you remember what you're saying?
No, I wished I did, and I haven't got a copy of it, haven't got anything of it at all, and it's pre all that lovely digital media stuff. Yeah, so much of my career has been recorded and digitized, but so much of it hasn't.
Did you meet Ed Sullivan?
Yep, sure did. Yeah, he was charming and, oh, not charming, but polite and well-mannered and fascinated by my Australian accent, which we laugh at because we think we just speak normally. It's you people that don't. No, he was, you know, he was all right. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So the good old days of rock and roll, you got that coming up in 2024. Are you continuing doing the podcast with Lex Marinos, the Baby Boomer Guide?
Yes, we're waiting on some good old funding at the moment. But, yes, we're feeling positive about that, and we will, and that's something that's certainly, well, not anymore, but it was new to me doing the podcasts, and I enjoy it very, very much. And all I can say is that it's great to be part of other people's worlds and to learn about them. We've had a great time so far recording them, and I'm hoping that within a few months we'll be have another series under our belt.
Oh, good stuff. Billy Thorpe was right when he said, Amphlett, get out there. Those bastards will love you. They certainly do, don't they?
He did. He did. And, yeah, I always remember that. And my mum, who'd taken me to that gig at Surf City, she wasn't a stage mum at all, but I was young. I had to be accompanied, you know. And she, as her habit was, she would leave me in the dressing room, suss out who else was there, you know, in that motherly way, but not say much at all. Make sure that I knew what I was doing, my clothes were there, ready to change, my music was sorted, etc. And then she would just leave and say, do well, I'll see you at the end. And during that time, I would usually sit, if there was a corner, I'd sit in the corner and, you know, the musicians would politely say hello, do you want a drink or anything I can get you? And no, thank you, no, thank you. And but it was Thorpey that sort of took me under his wing that night, and that's how our relationship was forever. Yeah, he was a treat.
Yes,
he was. Yeah, he. You know, I got on with him very well, and I thought the world of him.
Yep, incredibly talented man.
Oh gosh, yeah. He was. You know, it's hard to name many other performers who had his, you know, it was like tuning on a, you know, a battery. He had conviction, commitment. He had determination as the second that he walked onto that stage. And it was as if he was saying to himself, you know, you're all going to love me like himself, like because I'm going to work so hard. And he did, and they did too. They loved him.
Yeah. Hey, Patty, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. The good old days of rock and roll. In March, you're back on the road again. In March, you celebrate another birthday. So good luck and have a wonderful.
I know, it's a big one.
It is, isn't it? Anything special? Anything special lined up for the big 7-5?
No, I'm just looking in my book to see what's on the day. Nothing. And it's a Sunday. Now, I'll probably have a gig to go to, knowing me. You know, that's what usually happens. And no, nothing special. And I don't have a gig that day yet. Maybe one will come in. But, look, we're everywhere this year. We're doing a couple in Sydney. There's Taree, Gosford, North Coast, Adelaide. I think we're going to Perth as well. It just, yeah, it's all good. And let's hope we all enjoy. Keep well, that's what we want to do. Keep well, but we want to stay as fit and healthy as we can.
Stay well and stay on stage and thank you so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks
Kevin. Thanks, Brian. See ya.
myself. I want you to love me when I feel down. I want you above me. I search myself. I want you to find me.
I forget myself. I want you to remind me. I don't want anybody else. When I think about you, I touch myself. Oh, I don't want anybody else. Oh, no, no, no. You're the one who makes me come running. You're the sun who makes me shine. When you're around, I'm always laughing.
I want to make you mine. I close my eyes and see you before me. Think I would die if you were to ignore me. If folk could see just how much I adore you. I get down on my knees. I'd do anything for you.
I don't want anybody else. When I think about you, I touch myself. Oh, I don't want anybody else. Oh, no, oh, no. I don't want anybody else. When I think about you, I touch myself. Oh, I don't want.
Think I would die if I were to ignore you.
There you go. That's a song. I wanted to play that for a number of reasons. One, because it is an absolutely amazing version of that Chrissy Amphlett song, I Touch Myself, done with little Patty in there. She was about fourth or fifth in. But Sarah McLeod's in there, Kate Sobrano, all the Deb Conway, you know, every leading female singer in Australia was involved in that project, and it was obviously for breast cancer awareness and education. So we want to always back that, but I also wanted to play that version of the song because little Patty mentioned there that, you know, oftentimes she'd be backstage doing backing vocals for Chrissy Amphlett during Divinyl songs, which I found really interesting.
I think that was a really beautiful song that you played, a great version of it. I wish all the fellas would do one for prostate cancer.
Should.
And
well, you can now go off your project now between now and the next episode will be to find a song that's fitting.
You know me though. Like the guy's doing a song for prostate cancer.
Yeah.
He's gonna be fingers up.
Yeah. Yep. But, I know.
I think we'll get somebody else to organise it. I'll muck it up. I'll make it too crass. It'll be no good.
Exactly. It'll be very tasteful if you're involved in it.
Yeah.
Actually, it'd be very tasteful if you're not involved in it. Now,
the way to go.
Let's meet this bloke that we talked about at the top of the show. He is by day the announcer on the platforms at Flinders Street Station and Richmond Station and all around the place. And by night, he's the lead singer and major songwriter of a band called Sordid Ordeal.
And for people that are perhaps unfamiliar with his work, if you've been on Platform 9, you've probably heard him go, okay, it's 3:05 here at Flinders Street. Coming up the next hour, we've got Madonna and Prince and the Broadmeadows train. That's where he got all his skills from, I reckon.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt whatsoever. His name is Lawrence Hewson.
Good man.
Lawrence, the voice of Flinders Street Station and the voice of Sordid Ordeal. How does that work for you?
It's an overuse of the voice. It's more voice than people need. You know, like you get, you know, a couple decades of emceeing and learning how to think on your feet under your belt. I'm also the host of an open mic night as well. And as you can imagine, every now and then, you know, the silence has to be broken by somebody.
Yeah.
Normally after a comedian leaves the stage, it's someone who fancies themselves a comedian. So, I've had to learn a lot to think on my feet, and it resulted in, you know, being able to walk into a platform you know, at a train station and give people an earful.
Fair enough. How long have you been singing in the band?
Oh, look, I've, you know, like most people, I've been, you know, singing in church choirs and bollocks since I was, you know, like 12. So the Sorted Ordeal's been around for 14 years. It's just we made the mistake of being one of those bands that focused a lot more on getting pissed and playing punk shows than actually recording and getting stuff done. So, you know, around 5 years ago, we really pulled our shit together and went, you know what, let's actually do something instead of just bumming around drinking piss.
Oh, we're glad you did, because I reckon the song's awesome. It's and I really like what your drummer's doing too. He's seems like he knows what he's doing, but the guitar sounds, and it's a really great song. So well done on that.
Thank you.
Glad you, you know, stopped just getting pissed and playing punk and actually got off your ass and recorded it, because it's worth it. It's
yeah, no, it took me a lot longer than it should have, but here we go.
Oh,
so do you write? Does. Do you write the songs, Lawrence? Where's the writing?
Yeah, I write all the music at the moment. The band is one of those. I feel like it's almost a rite of passage for Australian bands to have a, you know, the past lineups has its own Wikipedia page. You know, when you go to like the Wikipedia page for Dragon, and then they're like, well, there's been a few members of Dragon. Click on this link here, and you go over to it, and the list just goes like that, and you're like, oh wow. So basically, every musician in Australia has had a crack. So awesome. But, I wrote all the music, so I didn't have to forfeit any songs over the years as lineups came and went. Fortunately, I've got the lineup I always dreamed of having now. But yeah, it was all my music. So I wrote the first two albums. The first one's just come out. Second album comes out later this year. And then we'll start doing a bit of collaborative work with everyone, because I'm very, very confident in the lineup I've got now. These are the people I want to be with in 10 years, you know?
Yeah, right. So are you working live at the moment?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We just had our album launch at Shotkickers in Thornbury. Yeah, sold out show. First one we played, which was amazing. Just jumped onto the Homegrown Festival lineup in Ballarat. So we'll be playing with Kiss Chasey and Slowly Slowly and that sort of festival that Destroy All Lines have pulled together. Had a couple bands reach out and say, do you want to come and do some support? So the Go Set are doing their 20-year anniversary at the Gasso in Collingwood. So we jumped on board that one. So, no, having a lot of fun playing live and, you know, like, I mean, it's the best fun you can have with your clothes on.
Yeah,
I mean, look, you know, you look at Iggy Pop and sometimes it's the best fun you can have with your clothes off too, I guess.
Correct.
But, no, it's nothing connects like playing live, you know, like you can record the best album in the world. I just don't really understand the ethos of a band like the Beatles that just go, oh, bugger it, you know, we won't play live anymore. We'll just record. I couldn't think of anything more boring. Like, I want to get sweaty. I want to get in your face. I want to jump into the pit. Like, I love doing garbage like that. So,
yeah, cool.
So, what's your vision for the band? Where are you taking the band?
I'd like to be touring Europe in the next 5 years. Yeah, I want to be, you know, supporting, you know, bands like Airborne and playing with great UK acts overseas, and you know, doing Germany and Netherlands and all those places. Like, you've been around, you know, Melbourne music scene for years, and you've watched, you know, band after band take off and start going doing the tour, and you're like, you know, I've got those itchy feet. I really want to do something large scale, do something big. So yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to get us to that point where we're doing that on a regular basis. And like so many, you know, great Australian bands are doing that at the moment, like, you know, Tame Impala and, as I mentioned, Airborne and the Rumjacks in Eastern Europe. Like, you know, Aussie bands get that opportunity to get that first plane ticket and they rarely come back and stay. And I would love to do that myself.
Yeah, I think your sound did work really well in Europe, particularly Germany. They seem to, you know, really like the heavy stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a dream to get over there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you don't have the radio shows and the backup and all that media wise in this country for your style of music. No one touches it. It's for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. It's always confused me a bit as well. It's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think radio just doesn't know what they're doing. They play so much shit. But, you know, I think if one radio station just played whatever it was coming out, and it'd be great. You know, I'd listen to it all the time. I don't want to hear Talking Heads or Phil Collins anymore.
You've rarely listened to any Australian radio station that isn't playing something old, and it's like, I think you've lost touch with your market audience there. And, you know, I mean, back in your day, like, you know, radio stations were playing whatever was coming out, and Yeah. And they were flogging it and people loved it. And it was invigorating. It was exciting. And it's just a bit of a shame because, as you can imagine, you know, being out and seeing gigs all the time, I see band after band that I just go, bloody hell, that'd be cracking on the radio. People would love this if more people knew it was there. But it's kind of relegated to the corner of people who, you know, are in touch with gigs, which isn't the average person. And if you're not in touch with it, you just kind of rely on whatever you're fed because, you know, life's busy and you're paying mortgages and raising kids. Like, it should be up to the media to give people something new and fresh and invigorating, and they're just not doing that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I agree. So where did you hear the music that you love? Where did you discover the bands that you love?
You know what? I had a bit of a sheltered childhood when it came to music. My parents were very much into what was, you know, big and famous in the 60s and 70s. And I thought some of that stuff was a bit soft. And so I went looking for new stuff. And most of the music that I got into, honestly, was personal recommendation. Like when I went through my, you know, Guitar Heroes phase, listening to Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, Yngwie Malmsteen, that was a instrumental metalhead who gave me that stuff. And there was a girl in high school who was like, "Have you heard Led Zeppelin?" Of course I hadn't, and I had no idea what it was about. So this is funny. Like, the best stuff I ever got into was just people giving me that. And once I sort of, you know, found what I liked, I started exploring on my own. It's that weird thing. It's like there were a lot of names floating around music world that I'd heard, but I didn't know what they sounded like because that just wasn't what was on at home. I mean, my home, it wasn't bad music. Like Johnny Cash and Neil Diamond and Neil Young and, you know, Glenn Campbell and John Denver, like, it's not bad stuff, but it's also a little bit limiting. And, like, you know, as grateful as I am for, you know, a pair of parents who got me into John Williamson from a young age, which I still flog, mind you.
Hey.
I've got to ask you about the train thing. It's the most unconventional day job for someone who does what you do at night.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's the funny thing about, like, playing music at night is that you're often, you know, you don't get home until either midnight or 1 in the morning. And honestly, like, I've just had to adapt to being up at 5 a.m., like, just out of necessity. I've done a lot of shit-kicker work in my time and, you know, working as a removalist for a few years and then Australia Post, like, that is, like, the morning job of morning jobs, being a postie, you know, and then working on the train stations. And so, like, I had to learn how to function on 4 hours sleep and function well.
Wow.
So your official role is are the voice of Flinders Street Station or Richmond Station or the public safety?
What they've got in at Flinders Street Station is platform announcers. So as you can imagine, during peak hour, like Flinders Street Station is the busiest train station in the Southern Hemisphere. It really is insane. Because unlike a lot of cities internationally, like all lines lead to Flinders. Like, it's not like the tube in London where, you know, all the lines crisscross and so you can get on one train to get to another line to get to another line and then bang, you're at your destination in 5 minutes. Everything goes into Flinders and everything goes out from Flinders. And so the amount of people we have, you know, plunging through is unbelievable. So what can happen is, you know, during peak hour with so much train traffic coming through, if even the slightest thing goes wrong on the network, it can start to throw the schedule out a little bit. So they put these platform announcers on the platform so that they can make quick fire announcements about a train moving from one platform to another. And that way people don't sit at the same platform with their headphones in for 45 minutes and go, "Why hasn't my train come?" And lo and behold, they find out they've been leaving from platform 9 the whole time and they're still sat on 5. Like, so yeah, it's this thing to sort of, you know, be a bit more engaged and keep people up to date on a much shorter basis. But yeah, as you can imagine, a lot of people just don't listen and they've got their headphones in anyway. So trying to crack through that noise, sometimes the best way to do it is with an overbloated announcement.
and then play a bit of Blackstrap and off you go.
Yeah, that's it.
that'll wake them up. They'll be alert to what's coming next.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll think that. I wonder if they're just waiting for the Hendrix track to start afterwards. It was funny. Like, I was down at Richmond Station for the Taylor Swift shows. They moved me down there just to sort of help with the crowd control aspect of it. And I can tell you, there's a lot of people that aren't prepared for something that sounds like Blackstraps coming out of the MCG after a Taylor Swift.
So what's the 2024 plan now? The album's out, obviously. Live gigging and stuff. Anything else?
Another album later in the year.
Yeah, another album later in the year. Yeah, like I've got a bit of a nostalgia for the old days. You know, when you look at like the old discography for like Hendrix or Zeppelin, and you're like, oh yeah, they released three albums in a year. Like they didn't just ham it on and, you know, blow on one album for 4 years straight. I just don't understand. Like, I've got a work ethic. I really want to get music out there. I've got, you know, albums worth of ideas that I want to do. So I was like, we'll do one at the start of the year, we'll do one at the back of the year, and then we'll release another one in the middle of next year, I reckon. So, yeah, just keep pumping out music and picking up live shows. I really want to establish Sorted Ordeal as like a classic Australian, you know, rock band that I hope will, you know, people will look back on the 2020s and say that was the band that defined that decade. Sorted Ordeal is, you know, quintessentially the 20s band.
There you go.
Good on you, Lawrence. Thanks for having a chat to us, mate. We're going to play Black Straps on the show and let people have a listen to what you sound like when you're not at Flinders Street Station.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you guys.
All right, we're going to play Black Straps, Lawrence's song in just a tick. He's a really interesting fellow. I really like him. I hope the band does really well for him. He's got high hopes for him, and I hope they exceed his expectations.
He'd be a good bloke to sit down and have a beer with, I reckon.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's rocking, and he's got a great attitude and positive outlook on life, and that's what we like.
Now, don't forget, we want to have a positive outlook on your driving life and ours, so go to Murcott's and be a better driver for all of us. Give them a call, for goodness sake.
Even if it's just, you know, you don't know where your indicators are, ring him up. He'll tell you how to put them on.
I'd love that.
Yeah, wouldn't that give you the shits? but, no, become a better driver. They are great. They taught me to be a Grand Prix driver, and I came seventh. So, you know, well done to Mark, and I'm a shit
more
driver.
More importantly, you survived, and so did everybody else in the race.
Yeah. 1-300-555-576. Give them a call. Buy a gift voucher for a friend that's a shit driver, and just keep everything safe.
Murcotts.edu.au. Coming up in programs soon, Judy Collins will talk to us about Both Sides Now and Sweet Judy Blue Eyes and all those great songs. Roger Glover from Deep Purple.
Oh, yeah, that was good. I liked that one.
He was good fun. Huey Lewis is going to have a chat. Tommy James from Tommy James and the Shondells is going to talk. And John Stevens also. So we've got some rippers coming up, Brian.
How about us, Kev? How about us? I think you've done a few of them without me, obviously early in the morning. How about you? How'd you go in the footy tipping this week, Kev?
Yeah, good question. I'm glad you asked. Let's play Black Straps by Sorted Ordeal. Thanks, Brian. See ya.
Cheers, Kev.
Beads of sweat run down the hourglass. With my name, being free is being king, but I signed it anyway. Now I'm locked behind two walls and lace lines of feeling. The dress is dripping, I'm a thigh and I'm grabbing, running, sand. Swimming through your fingers and it's raining red today. Revenants about it on a hill. Above the ground, hey.